I will talk, or I will give a divided talk, but both parts, the first part will be rather short, and both parts will refer to an exhibition project which I'm involved in and which is currently on view in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands. In 1964, the American Justice Potter Stewart was about to decide the case of a manager of a movie theater who was convicted under a state obscenity law of possessing and exhibiting an allegedly obscene film. Though Mr. Stewart admitted not to be able to define what pornography is, we heard of these problems by in the talk of Thomas Ballhausen, although he was not able to define it in detail, he ultimately trusted in the evidence of the eye. He said, this is his famous quote, "I know it when I see it." Here are some examples of what some people in the Netherlands, probably not you, I guess, consider as pornography, but is confronted in this exhibition project with real explicit pornographic materials. So, this is David David from the outside. A film poster on the facade introduces the theme. On it, it's written "The Birth of Feminism." This is a work from 2001. It announces a film that only can be played in our heads. Three actresses who were the best known sex symbols at the time of the work's production pose on the poster as pin-up girls. Pamela Anderson, Halle Berry and Katharina Zeta-Jones as the leading actresses for a film whose title alludes to Griffith's classic The Birth of a Nation from 1915. The Guerrilla Girls, an anonymous American collective in existence since 1985, with an undefined number of members who always appear in public wearing gorilla masks, have concerned themselves since their inception with the feminist-inspired witty infiltration of prevailing meaning production in popular culture, art, and advertisements linked to blind spots in art institutional practice. The banner reading "Equality Now," placed across the hips, alludes not only the names of an international women's rights organization, but also can be read as the smallest common denominator of the diverse activities carried out by the three American feminists supposedly portrayed in this fictive film, which are named Gloria Steinem, Flo Kennedy, and Bella Abzug. Fine name, Bella Abzug. The poster names as the film director the chronicler of presidents, wars, and other strokes of fate demanded by male heroes and their epics, Oliver Stone. The man responsible for the soundtrack is the white US rapper Eminem, who in his artistic delirium, consisting of cascades of dirty words, relishes the role of the bad boy, calling his own mother a whore and stylizing himself as the victim of women and as a women hater. The Birth of Feminism, the impossible blockbuster, is produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, one of the most successful Hollywood players, who financed, amongst others, the film Pirates of the Caribbean, which served as a blueprint, as we heard before, for the most expensive porn film to date, Pirates from 2005. In this way, too, science can fall victim to pirates. So, this is the entrance. On the last staircase section before reaching the gallery, there's an arrangement of printed rules from a work venue that usually guards itself against any critical transparency, a strip joint. In Baby Doll Saloon from 1992, Angela Bullock transfers the instructions for problem-free operation seen on a toilet door in New York's Baby Doll Lounge to the art space. As the first installment of Bullock's rule series began in 1992, the texts reflect the social specificity of behavior in different settings which they present via their relocation to an audience who is able to read it them in a detached manner, as simply one text amongst others. So this is a room which comes a little bit closer to the subject of this conference, the machines. This room deals with the porn cinema boom in the 70s. who however cared less for the technological fetish than for the imagery of what had hitherto been forbidden, for exceeding shame barriers and overcoming prudery. This moment is remembered by Image Virus from 1989, the AIDS wallpaper by the famous Canadian homosexual artistic trio General Idea, which is of course a modification of the even more famous Love logo from or by Robert Indiana. The green door, which you see there, refers to the famous porn movie and is a sort of installation by the German artist Johann Wohnzeifer. And next to it, you can't see it properly, but there's it's in the wall. There's a work by Andrea Fraser, she allows a glimpse into her bedroom with a controversial video Untitled from 2003. Andrea Fraser commissioned her gallerist to look for a collector willing to pay her to have sex with her. A fixed video camera recorded the contractually stipulated sexual work of 1 hour in an hotel room. Body art as a service to the customer who, like the active collector, can become part of a work himself, or who, like the passive observer, can be thrown back onto his own curiosity. So, this is a nice work by the artist Robert Müller, who sees eroticism not as bodily encounters, but in relation to the Duchamp and Tinguely bicycle constructions as the coupling of man and machine. The reproduction of this sculpture, The Cyclist Widow from 1957, it's a replica, is an autoerotic fantasy turned into metal, a technological complication producing pain and lust which lapses into the absurd. This is called a bachelor machine in reference to Marcel Duchamp's The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors, Even, also known as The Large Glass from 1915. Also the imaginations of authors such as Alfred Jarry, Raymond Roussel and Franz Kafka. This is not an installation out of King Kong, but it's by the artist Tom Burr. He has reacted to the so-called Disneyfication of Times Squares in the early 90s, and this work is from 1995, and he did that with an exhibition in the New York Gallery of American Fine Arts. He displaced its former architectural elements, their forms and materials, processed through the desubjectivizing aesthetic of minimalism, transforming them into sexuality, or into sexually suggestive sculptures with titles such as Video Booth. The transfer of suppressed street furniture, such as toilets or video booths, onto the white cube thus generated willful and memorable objects referring to erased subcultures. With this more recent work, Put Down and Put Out from 2003, Burr continues with his archaeological work on disappeared, non-regimented or wild habitats. His black horse stable sculptures, the brittle equipment, the mask and the blanket in the White Gallery conjure up the dressage of drives, the domestication of the animal and, in contrast, the well-calculated excess in the SM facility. The intention to arouse and stimulate is generally considered to be a central aspect to distinguish between the commodified sexuality, as it is staged in pornography, and art, which deals with lust, desire, and explicit material. Given that, is pornographic art a contradiction in itself? And on the other hand, can pornography always be reduced to this single point? And what happens to explicit visualizations when they are transformed into a protected, institutionalized art context, where they necessarily start to communicate with artworks surrounding them, like we have seen before? These are some of the questions which are raised in this exhibition called Body Politics. Body Politics with an X, of course, is opened since the beginning of this September at Witte Witt. And is this show is not aimed to be shown for people under 18. And because it's really also offensive to some audiences, we already experienced that. And this decision was made in order to hold off. It might probably no longer limited to the ones constituting interaction of commercial publication and reprivatization of the consumption. Therefore, I would like to continue with some rather general notes on the status and the different layers of meaning of what often is called the pornification of society. If sexuality is linked with discourse, then pornography is joined with media. As the internet democracy clicks along, the images of seduction in circulation articulate this clearly. Pornography is everywhere. Porn films are special goods given an added value to other commodities. Pornography is infiltrating the mainstream, booming in niches. It is found in the popular, the elite, the everyday, and in art. It floods all types of media whose voyeurism and greed for physical signs of excitement occasionally reveals the media's latent pornographic character. Always on the lookout for the thrill of the hidden, for taboos that must be teased, must be broken, and yet simultaneously maintained. So in saying that society is becoming pornographic, then two things are implied. First, pornography that explicitly regards itself as such is expanding and developing. And secondly, pornographic allusions and references are infiltrating culture. To begin, let us hear to the field that calls itself pornography. At first, there will be few objections to the understanding of average porn as the rationalized masturbation-centered regulation of male, or mainly male, visual desires into cumshot corsets. A strand of feminist criticism, ranging from Andrea Dworkin in the United States to the now renewed porno campaign in Germany, this is for the third time now, this campaign, has been interpreting porn in this way since the 1970s. If we ignore the gay and lesbian scenes, which are then it's the dominant form of pornography can be still considered, I guess, a symbol of patriarchal power expressed through heterosexual desire. Yet in the meantime, the porn industry has diversified, producing offshoots into which different desires and gender codes are inscribed. Parallel to the grim glamour of the porn Oscars and the sex factories of the San Fernando Valley, an underground scene is enjoying a wild growth spurt. I skipped that through because we talked about that quite a lot. And I also will skip some examples of what I mean with the infiltration of the mainstream, but I'm sure you probably know a lot of films and books and so on which are dealing with this. The so-called porno chic, so it seems, is obligatory for gossipy consumers nowadays. A dirty, glittering sex promise of emotion, an inexhaustible generator of entertainment, and it is taboo titillation, greedily sucking up everything in fashion, advertising, pop, or hardcore experiments in arthouse cinema and galleries, and feeding it back to a society that has made a daily routine out of milking taboos. Today's expanding sex industry inexhaustibly preaches the consumer fairy tale of sexual self-realization, cheerfully producing one after the other such things as swinger clubs, intimate piercings, vinyl and leather outfits, S&M toy supermarkets, telephone hotlines, webcams, and so on for egoistic exhibitionist entrepreneurs. The process of demystifying what used to be called perversions has been progressing since the 1990s. As long as you can turn it into money or a television series like The L Word. The frequently mentioned pornographization of society, however, not only manifests itself as the infiltration of media, One example is the afternoon television. Two men view for a woman, or alternatively, one woman for two men, dismissed. The MTV dating show not only forces the body fetishizing elimination principle of Welbeck's sexual market economy, but also the crisis of sexuality in the age of increasing pornographization. In the show, sexual encounters are practiced in a post-pubescent step plan, being considered with a rather matter-of-fact distance as an open trait of bodies and desires. As the director's command, French kisses are performed. People swear to their own sexual openness, or else the other is put to the test. Although actions, confessions, and speeches are routinely performed in front of the camera in rehearsed, conformist, sexy poses, emotions seem withered and desire appears to be shut down. The pornographic element of dismissed might lie in the way that supposedly intimate pre-sexual courting rituals are put on display for the benefit of a voyeuristic third party, namely the anonymous audience. This voyeur in front of the television is like any other voyeur that might be present without having been invited. Because, of course, the purpose of the whole show is to offer enough entertainment value to keep the voyeur tuned in. In contrast, the sexual drama of desire and its postponement, desire and the way it is symbolized, is diffused and simplified because it is reduced to a thematic narrative procedure and act of speed. In Dismissed, people present themselves as cool and calculating, without false modesty or delusions. Yet, nobody actually desires anybody, and even less seeks to be desired by the other. If, as Kant said, the beauty of an object really could be described through the disinterested pleasure of the viewer, then everything pornographic would be ugly. For the producers of pornography pursue enormous interests. These interests could be examined according to social, gender, theoretical or aesthetic criteria, or the criteria of body politics. Obviously, it is the market value of commodified sexuality that is of primary importance to porn producers. The objectified bodies in contemporary pornography are not supposed to be pleasing. They are supposed to excite and stimulate potential customers without having to justify certain dark motifs in a way that most other fields of representation would be obliged to. Even the glamorized female porn stars operating on the cusp of social acceptance are not simply distant fetishized surfaces for the projections of the fans. They are also humiliated and degraded objects, attainable through media, and the powerless yet tyrannical fan is permitted to participate in the process of documenting this degradation through the power hidden in the complicit male perspective that has the female body at its mercy. Why is pornography so successful? Probably because pornography does not present any arguments, but like violent films, which are very similar in their structural details, it strives to overwhelm and move the body. Move, under quote. Very likely pornographic images exaggerate a characteristic that distinguishes the image in general. Images, writes German art historian Hans Belting, demand our belief, but they are not made to convince us. Rather, they are made for the purpose of impressing us. Pornography systematically denies even its most obvious artificiality. It operates in the sense of Walter Benjamin's Spur. That means his media technological term that is set in opposition to the aura and which promises proximity to something that has long been lost. Porn movies try to convey unfakeable signs of physicality through technological media. And in contrast to eroticism, which operates through symbolism, there are always too few or too many of these signs. You have to look or look away. In particular, crude reality porn flicks don't even have a pretense of a plot. extreme gonzo films and some wild alternative porn reject the obviously fictional and overproduced in favor of portraying what they consider to be radical authenticity. The body speaks, and its words are instrumentalized as the effects of reality, pretending to satisfy the hunger for real excess. Gonzo director John Stagliano explained heterosexual pornography's fixation on anal sex, which has been increasing since the 1990s, as the attempt to violently open up the body. Quote, and the really knowledgeable viewer compulsively asks himself, bent over his pumping fist, is that actually real too, or is it bullshit? That's where their personality emerges. End of quote. Penetration and documentation, is that the way pornographic strategy pursues that the will to knowledge, as Michel Foucault analyzed it through the example of sexuality? 30 years ago, right in the middle of the hangover resulting from the previous years of sexual liberation, the French theorist diagnosed the accelerating compulsion of to confess as the central characteristic of the modern way of dealing with sexuality. From the Catholic confessions to psychoanalysis, from modern gender studies to the media's constant questioning, and on to therapeutic self-questioning, the intensification of the discourse of the body and its desires can be traced. Foucault sharply objected to the leftist hypothesis of puritanical repression, as it was represented, for instance, in the historical documentary Inside Deep Throat, made about the porn hit Deep Throat. Instead, Foucault interpreted the increasing talk about sex as an indication that, since the 17th century, the body has been suspected of being the source of secret knowledge. According to Foucault, the discourse produces sexuality before any practice occurs in all of sexuality's mysterious desire to explore. Discourse takes sexuality and makes a science out of it, turns it into a moral and a political object, considering it as a form of knowledge that makes it possible to express things about subjects and the way they are subjected. Even since the 17th century, people, spurred on by an untiring scientia sexualis, have continually been deciphering and analyzing new hidden truths that are affirmed, decoded, and used to satisfy their own desire for the desire of knowledge. Tell me about or show me your sex, and I'll tell you who you are. The desire to destroy intimacy, the dialectics of taboo and violation, and the competitive excesses of transgression can be found in the pioneering work of modern pornography by the Marquis de Sade, who was also so obsessed with mechanical interconnections. His physically technical experiments are ruthless machines of disciplined dissipation, excessive and joyless. They plumb the depths of the unstable territory between absolute freedom and absolute horror, radical democracy and despotism. Orgies of sex and violence, systematically breaking every taboo, serve to link desire and pain. And the lessons of a dark education will help one to realize the truths wrung from this regarding the supposedly fundamental amoral nature of the sexual. In Philosophy in the Boudoir, the converted Eugenie, at last free of the moral repression Desart has so furiously fought, gives way to her supposedly natural desires and is ready to lead the life of a libertine, without making any claims to sexual ownership. She says, "Now I'm completely broken. Now, my dear, are you satisfied with your pupil? Am I now whore enough?" The body is supposed to express itself, and pornographic praxis helps to do it so. What in all of this is enjoyed, feared, and desired? And how? How can one understand the interplay between a media apparatus designed to steer sexual thrills and the viewer who are at the mercy of these images, whilst also enjoying being at their mercy. In thinking about pornography's aesthetics of affect, Roland Barthes examined the gap that appears between an intentional, rational perspective, which can operate as a studium, and the actual affective effect of images. In Reflections on photography, he identifies the element that escapes the study of photographic order as the punctum, an element that is unpredictable and also affects the viewer with desire or pain. This element acts outside the control of the viewer. It, quote, shoots like an arrow out of its context and bores right through me, end of quote. Barth describes this injury to, or this disturbance of, the viewer as an effect of looking at a photograph, an effect over which the viewer has no control. Today, diverse visual subcultures, including those beyond sexual stimulation, consciously aim for this effect. For instance, one more kick to the opponent already lying on the ground, and the wobbly camera zooms in greedily. Some DVDs, easy to buy on the internet, made by and featuring violent hooligans, contain raw material from police videos, surveillance cameras, and amateur videos shot in front of and inside soccer stadiums. I show you some example of this. A short note in German, which basically says that the filmmaker is not responsible for promoting violence, which of course is absurd. The entire film is structured in a lot of like little capitals, and which are titled after the matches where the hooligans meet each other. So okay, let's go on in this comparison of these videos and porn. The brutal, extreme forms of gonzo deal with the transitory zones of violence and sexuality involving gangbangs, bukkake orgies, spankings, and more or less simulated rapes. It is exactly as if the old feminist thesis of pornography is the theory, rape is the practice, by Robin Morgan, is being maintained by the practice of the theory. Catherine MacKinnon's argument can be applied here, or maybe applied here. In her 1993 book, Only Words, pornography is classified in politically correct rhetoric as hate speech, and MacKinnon demanded that it should be prohibited in the Constitution. The reason? Pornography itself is an act of oppression and discrimination. It actually is what it pretends to simply present, a model of anti-female sexuality with an immense amount of power to influence reality. The performance captured on film is not just a fictionalization of real relationships, as it is also argued in the debate about the effect of violence in the media when it occasionally flares up. Rather, it is itself the link between fantasy and reality. Although hard gonzos have in fact long since developed in their own methods beyond sexist heterosexual normality by sometimes perfidiously transmitting the regulated perspective and hierarchy of victimization of straight, gay and lesbian constellations, they do not resemble the usual porn movie, which portrays desire, or at least the way desire is supposedly awakened through stimulation against one's will. Instead, certain gonzos are about enjoying the desperation, enjoying the degradation and humiliation of the victims, who don't even pretend to feel desire. The victims, most of whom are female, are beaten, insulted, ridiculed, and drowned in bodily fluids. Obviously, in the hope of achieving the degree of disgust, fear, and abasement that can no longer be hidden, so that an undisguised emotional truth is divulged. This is supposed to permit the internal, in both the physical and the psychological sense, to be realized. The invisible is made visible. Both heart pornography and sublime art coincide at this point, at least if you agree with a view of art formulated by Paul Klee, an Austrian artist. According to him, art is not about reproducing the visible, but rather about making the previously invisible visible. However, these physical confessions, contrasted with Foucault's ambivalent interpretation of the productivity of the sexual discourse, do not result in this kind of governmentality affected subject. Rather, they force the objectified performer into a more or less plausibly performed animalism. This compulsive confession is not interested in making the oppressed individual productive, but rather in ignoring the subjective in favor of sexual roles and stereotypes. It is not about forcing a kind of knowledge whose communicative dimension is always engaged in appropriating the uncontrollable moment, thus also planning corrections and designs to counteract the dominant ascribed roles. Pornography today seems unavoidable. Maybe the displeasure about its prevalence is the reason why pornography is also used as a means to create representations that provide alternative images. Beside the countless do-it-yourself who tend to be more interested in playing with attention and anonymity than in commerce, there are also producers who are interested in self-determined desires, refractory aesthetics, and a stubborn sort of identity politics, such as the provocative porn-punk filmmaker Bruce LaBruce, or the film collective Panic Culture from Paris, which strives to set aside ascribed gendered sexual roles. This so-called post-pornographic activism, described by theorist Beatrix Preciado in her Manifest Contrasexual as a communism of the body existing under the principle of the equalizing dildo, unites desires beyond the dictatorship of the phallus. To think and to act post-pornographically does not mean attacking the pornographization of society from an imaginary outside. Instead, we should think of an arena in which battles over body politics are carried out. In contrast to the understanding of pornography as violence directed towards women and or as a way of portraying women, this approach attempts to provide liberating images and performative individual ideas as an antidote to the commercial sex industry. This will also help to overcome the unholy alliance with conservative and religious powers who through the repression of sex equip in with an unhealthy dark power whose effects are inscribed in our bodies and desires. Post-pornographic activism positively affirms alienation and the fetish. All that is technical and artificial about sexuality. It rejects the truth of biology that seeks to establish male and female sexualities. And it breaks with the exaggerated logic of taboo and transgression, whose echoes lately can be heard in the New York cinema of transgression as practiced by directors like Richard Kern, which has been influenced by the pretended and actual battles against censorship carried out in the 70s. However, post-pornographic auteur porn films will only be really exciting when they no longer simply try to inscribe their desires of individual minorities, such as gay men or lesbians, for instance, into the extant pornographic panorama, which is always continually expanding. Of course, this practice does lead to a welcome diversity of voices, weakening normative heterosexuality through other sexualities. Yet in closing up their own identities, which as strategic sexism practiced by the victims of sexism is completely understandable, they remain trapped inside the desire for a clearly delineated sexual self. Contrastingly, the actual vanishing point of the post-pornographic practice seems to exist in what is basically an open-ended sexual identity, a bold variation which can be practiced as both performance and as a form of representation within the pornographic act. Has nothing to do with becoming oneself, but with becoming strange, becoming different. Why can't a man become a lesbian? The German band FSK once asked in their song 1 plus 1 is 3. At that point, it would indeed be possible for pornography to dream of it itself as something else. It could be a practice that does not backtrack to the traditional detour around the erotic or sink into the fake hyperrealism of the power constructs made up of real perpetrator and victim, but instead constantly alters the pornographic script. Tell me about your sex, and you tell me that you and you will tell me what you want to be. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, questions?
Yeah, thanks for your talk. I like the way you move sort of in between like a political critique and the images that you've been working with. I was wondering if you'd be willing to sort of riff for us on what do you think a liberatory image of a woman would look like?
This is, of course, a really hard question to answer, and I think that a lot of also female producers in also within the porn industry, but also just in the porn field as an independent producers are seeking for that. But I guess the main answer would be that the female body is not limited to the real existing body and its function to the male desire, so that it can change the so-called gender role. And for instance, like I mentioned, this French collective called Panic Culture, they do such films where it's not so easy to desire who is the one who fucks and who is the one who is fucked. So it's kind of productively confusing this order.
I guess just following up on that, so a liberating image of a woman is one in which she is able to switch genders and you can't tell who is who. So if a woman becomes a man in pornography and is fucking, that's liberating. Is that would be an example of?
I guess this is one of the idea in my experience which these producers would promote. Yes, I think so. I wouldn't claim that this is a satisfying answer, but it is one direction people tend to, I think.
So I had a question based on that. For me, because I've worked in, I still work in pornography, a lot of it, which is degrading because I kind of get off on that. But that's another story. But why is it that a woman being degraded is such, why you think it's such a cultural thing? Because there's a vast and a lot of pornography that degrades men in that same type of manner. For example, kink.com's Men in Pain does that. It's, and there's plenty of it out there where the woman's in control. How does that make it any different from it being a liberating perspective when it's all based around a fantasy, not so much a interpretation of real life activities?
First of all, I tried to reconstruct some of the main positions of feminist critique, which have been completely ignored around this entire conference and which are still around. So this is not my position, but I try to reconstruct that or to try to keep that in mind. And the other thing is, as I try to elaborate a little bit on this so-called reality effect of porn, I think that in contrast to the, of course, to the fantasy world, which pornography obviously is about, it, everything is staged, and it's a way of putting fantasies into a picture, of course. But on the other hand, I think it a lot of porn is about going to this point where the body can't lie anymore, and this is this effect of reality, and this effect is. Has something to do with, I think, often with victimization and the regular, the dominant victimization is, of course, of women. Of course, you're right that this also can be applied to male bodies also, and it is in a lot of porn. But this would be a point, I think, which I try to talk about a little bit. Porn is about two things. It's about fantasies and also about reality. It's intertwined in a strange way, I think.
Maybe I got this wrong, but did you call it the Sadian protagonist joyless? You mentioned this more or less mechanical catalogue of desire, cruelty, and so on into the Sadian works, and in a way you refer to them as joyless. So maybe you can say something about that?
Maybe this was a wrong translation. I didn't want to say that there's nothing going on about desire and so on, but rather that it is very, that it is like functioning like a disciplinary or a ballet of bodies. Yeah, that's what I basically wanted to say. So that it's about ecstasy, but it is very extremely limited, extremely structured in every detail, and it has this logic of calculated excess. So this would be the idea why I called that joyless in that sense.
Concerning the structure of porn movies, like. That's basically totally a fact, because if you see like how porn movies are structured, it's always like this continual reproduction of the same scenes and the same practices. So there's like a lot of porn is basically like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and that goes on. Okay, one or two more questions? Okay, if not, then I guess. Thank you very much, Thomas Ehlinger.